Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Hey, Vince.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. You didn't get any wild parties over the weekend, did you?
No.
No drugs?
No, none that I'm going to admit on the air. I'll put it that way.
No police, anything...
No drama like that, no. Yeah, well. Those days are long gone, I'm sorry.
Well, fortunately, that's all
if
in the
they
movie.
Ever existed.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's all covered in this movie though, so we'll have that going for us. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new high school comedy, Booksmart. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including San Diego Comic-Con. It's coming up on us again, and at least one big studio is taking a break this year. So what's Comic-Con's place in the movie universe now? And then we will ask the question if box office failure is proof of cinematic failure, because the best movies sometimes make the least money, and we'll talk about some of the best failures. And then finally, it's the 35th birthday this week of both Ghostbusters and Gremlins. Why are we still trying to recapture that Ghostbusters magic, and why doesn't anyone give Joe Dante work anymore? But first, Rocket Man, the biopic about Sir Elton John, is currently in theaters everywhere, and it prompted an article in The Guardian that posited that it may not be such a great thing that artists are involved in their own making their own story. And this follows up on last year's Oscar winner, Bohemian Rhapsody, which was also made rather heavily with the involvement of members of Queen, Brian May and Roger Taylor primarily.
Yeah, I haven't seen Rocketman. As you said, the article mentioned both of those films. Mm-hmm. I would have to concur with Bohemian Rhapsody, though. I did feel like it was kind of... And I don't really know anything about Queen, but I do know biopics, right? I do know what they should do. And I just felt like it was very watered down, you know? Yeah. It's like when people are talking about, I wish they had gone into Freddie Mercury's sexuality a little more, okay? They're not talking about some glib reference to the fact that he's gay, okay? They're talking about, like, there's got to be more... Mm-hmm. that he experienced as it pertains to that, right? So right. It's like, I'm actually in agreement with that. They kind of tiptoed around that subject.
Right. It's not so much that they didn't deal with Freddie Mercury's gayness. It's that, you know, in the context of the movie, it seems like his gayness sort of comes out when he meets this other character who ends up having like a negative effect on him beyond just like being a boyfriend,
right?
Being a gay figure. And it plays into this trope of, you know, the wily gay man who will, you know, turn you and distort you and, you know, turn you away from your friends, that, you know, that this trope that gayness is a thing best avoided. And of course, then Freddie Mercury is diagnosed with AIDS, which is, of course, long been seen in some quarters as a punishment for gayness. And then the movie kind of leans into that, too. And I think that without the involvement of Queen in that movie, it probably tips a bit closer to being the Freddie Mercury story.
For which, sure, yeah.
Because he's the most dynamic character.
Right, and who actually loses as a result of all this diluting, right? It's the audience. It's not Rami Malek who walks away with an Oscar. It's not Dexter Fletcher, right?
Future Bond villain Rami Malek.
Right. It's not Anthony McCarten who wrote the screenplay. It's the guy that worked 40 hours a week who was looking forward to just having a good time. I did not mean that as a reference, I promise you. That's just like how clever I am. It just comes out, right?
No, yeah. You're subconsciously
it's that guy,
clever.
It's that guy that is ready to sit down and see a good movie and instead get something that's kind of ho-hum.
Or, you know, maybe not even aware of it even too, because, you know, so many of us sort of take movies at face value.
Right. And And there are other, like, bigger examples, I think, right? Mm-hmm. For instance, I'll give you an example. Last year, right, the documentary mm-hmm. Quincy comes out about mm-hmm. Quincy Jones, right? And mm-hmm. who directed that? Well, it was Rashida Jones, his daughter. It's like, well, there goes any idea that this is going to be impartial or right. objective in any way, shape, or form. And you might be saying, well, that was not her intention. And it's right. like, well, fine, but, you know, you have to realize that you're making this for an audience too, right?
People don't want to just see your whole movies.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly don't want an hour and a half love letter to your father. I'm sorry. which is kind of what it turned out to be.
Right. right.
And you saw it back in 2014 too, right? When Clint Eastwood was going to do American Sniper. What did Chris Kyle's family say to him? They're like, you better not like disrespect the memory of my son. I would have been like, excuse me, like this is my film. I'm going right. to do it the way that I want to, right?
Right.
And then of course what happened? He like gave into that and they made a very kind of I don't know how to describe it. It was very pandering to like
right.
those sentiments, right? And it's like,
well, it doesn't go deep into, like, clearly he had PTSD issues, and it, like, and that looks, that can be very, very ugly when experienced for the person and for their right. family, too. And instead, it was a very kind of Hollywood version. I mean, and Clint Eastwood being, like, sort of one of the last vestiges of old Hollywood, he kind of maybe isn't as, doesn't have the instinct to be as cutting edge as like maybe you would like or maybe I would like. And of course, you know, he recently did the, what was it, the 1517 to Paris, where he went a step further and cast the actual guys who were the heroes on that train to play themselves. And
yeah.
I mean, that's also not giving yourself sufficient distance to, you know, really engage in your subject when you're actually working with the subject.
Right. So now you have a situation where it's like, I not only have to tell an entertaining, engaging story that's truthful, but I also have to appease the real people. They might not admit that, right? Like the people mm-hmm. who worked on American Sniper might not admit that they were influenced by or at least intimidated by the reception of the family. But that's probably that. I think it's absurd to say that that didn't factor into it, right?
Right.
And I do understand why they do it, because the consequences are so devastating, right? You just saw that last year with Green Book, right? Now you've got Don Shirley's family going, no, this is not how it happened, right?
Right.
Like, my father was not friends with Viggo Mortensen's, like, you know what I mean? It was not right. a jolly old road trip. And now you've got, right, and who are people going to believe? Are they going to believe the family of Don Shirley or Nick Vallelonga, who's been working in Hollywood for 20 years, who is trying to make a buck? It's
well,
like,
I mean, that's an interesting case because it's a tale about two people. It's from the son of one of the people involved, and the family of the other person involved to say it has a different version of the events. So, that's an interesting case, because like whose version do you believe?
Exactly. I think most people, if they heard the real family coming out like kind of defacing it, they would go with the family, right? It's mm-hmm. like, well, this is the actual, they knew mm-hmm. Don Shirley personally, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're also not filmmakers, right? They're also not going to be sympathetic to the kind of things that a filmmaker needs to do, which is kind of embellish things in service of entertainment.
Right.
But you need to balance both of them, right? One of my favorite biopics of all time is Raging Bull, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, is anybody saying what a horrible human being Jake LaMotta is? No, they're saying it's an amazing work of art, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it contains, and I think we can all see a little bit of ourselves in Jake LaMotta, somebody who is exceptional in one area of his life, but was extremely lacking in other areas of his life. That, for me, is more representative of real life, of what human beings are actually like, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also,
I think it depends if, you know, whether or not the subjects and the, you know, who's in the driver's seat? Is it the director or is it the family or whoever's connected to the subject? Because you look back at The Doors, the Oliver Stone movie about the band The Doors.
Yeah.
Two of the old band members were like consultants. But even they admit that, you know, they would go to set, they would tell Oliver Stone what something was like, and then Oliver Stone would do what he wanted, because he was trying to make, you know, a movie that was his story, that was his interpretation of the life of Jim Morrison.
Right. And you heard Aaron Sorkin say something very similar about The Social Network,
yes.
which is what that article brought up as kind of maybe the epitome of kind of a good objective, like, biopic, right?
I'm not sure it's objective, but
fair enough. That was not. It was
but it's
maybe
not,
more critical, sorry.
Right?
But Aaron Sorkin was saying when he first started writing that, right? He was trying to do the kind of millennial voice and dialogue, right? And he just couldn't do it. He was like, I had to scrap it, and I had to do my classic Aaron Sorkin dialogue, right? So you do have to give, right? When you try too hard to appease to, like, everybody, you end up just watering down all of those voices, right? Which is what you were saying about Bohemian Rhapsody, right? Like, we were talking about months ago. Whose vision was it? Was it Dexter Fletcher's? Or was it Bryan Singer's, right? It's like, now it's
or
kind
was
of
it
a
Queen's?
Yeah, it's just kind of a mess, right? It's like... Yeah.
Dexter Fletcher, of course, is also the director of Rocket Man. So it's this weird kind of.
And I noticed he was kind
shared
of.
Shared universe.
Yeah. And I noticed just because of. There's a lot of previews in the Cineplex pre-show, but he's kind of trying to pawn it off as like Elton John was like, go do your thing. And then we just kind of did our version, right? And he gave us carte blanche. And it's like, well, I don't think. That's what happened. But on the topic of Oliver Stone, sorry if I can just labor, he also did one of, I think, one of the greatest biopics ever made, Born on the 4th of July. And he worked with Ron Kovic, the real guy, through the entire process, right? He co-wrote the script with him. Even Tom Cruise, after every take, would go up to Ron Kovic on set and be like, you know, how was that, Ron? Was that good, right? So here's an example of a guy who worked very, very, very closely with everyone, was very involved in the process, and they ended up making a masterpiece. They ended up making an absolute magnificent work of art.
Maybe Tom Cruise's best work as an actor.
Yeah, I would agree.
As like an acting actor, I mean, you can almost push aside like the Mission Impossible stuff, which is incredible physicality. Different, but like as an actor and the and in terms of the acting craft, Born on the 4th of July, Tom Cruise at his best.
Yes, and sorry, I was gonna add on to Born on the 4th of July. Maybe we should just
I'll say another one.
Sorry, I remember.
Okay.
I'm sorry to cut you off. But there is something to be said, if I can play devil's advocate, for the fact that maybe Ron Kovic had less to lose than, say, Queen or, let's say, Elton John, right? It's like, this turns out to be a bad movie. It's like, it's not going to harm my reputation and my life the way that it would for Elton John. So therefore...
Yeah, Ron Kovic's not still touring,
Right.
So to speak.
But you can see how he thought that victory, right? His whole life, the victory was making... a good film, right? It wasn't how much money the movie made or what awards it won.
Right.
It was like, the victory is getting to tell this story the way that happened.
Well, I mean, Queen is still touring with Adam Levine. I think Elton John is like undertaking like what's supposed to be his last tour. But you know, you go back to Alex Cox's Sid and Nancy, where, you know, Sex Pistols. Sorry, I was getting my band's confused, but Sex Pistols aren't touring anymore. So, you know, Alex Cox can do this like harrowing, like deeply kind of disturbing look at this at times horrible but loving relationship. But even Johnny Rotten came out after that movie came out and said like that Cox got a lot of it wrong or that it's not representative. But I don't think that takes anything away from Sid and Nancy. Still like a harrowing experience to watch.
The same way that Amadeus is like very fictionalized, but also, right? It could be argued that Amadeus is responsible for ruining Antonio Salieri's like entire reputation.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And Antonio Salieri was like a genius in his own right, right? He was not the jerk that Amadeus made him out to be.
Yeah.
But as a result of that, we've now ruined his reputation. So it's like, But is the art, is the result that they made, like, worth it? I would say it was. So it's very interesting. I don't know.
Of course, Mozart and Salieri aren't touring anymore.
Yes, we're hundreds of years, and his family is not going to come out with, you've manipulated history here.
You've ruined his record sales.
Right.
Right. Speaking of record sales, in a different way, San Diego Comic-Con starts in a couple of weeks. We kind of talk about Comic-Con when it comes up every year, whether or not it's still relevant. I'm not sure this helps. Warner Brothers has announced that they're skipping this year, although they could be back in 2020.
Which they said they will.
Yes. But it's still, what's interesting is that this is a studio with like Comic-Con friendly
films,
stuff
yeah.
to sell. So they have Joker coming up, Birds of Prey, Wonder Woman 1984, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, and Godzilla versus Kong. So, you know, they have this like great Comic-Con ready stuff, but they're not going.
What was the official reason they gave for not doing it? Because what I heard was that it was just a matter of timing. It had nothing to do with the integrity of the actual event. It was all just a matter of timing. So they're going to be back for 2020.
Well, I mean, that's what they say.
Right.
But, you know, there's a difference between what
there
you
might
say
be an underlying feel that they don't think it's relevant.
Well, I mean, it could be. But, you know, it's weird because last year you had Disney skip out on Comic-Con on the cusp of, you know, having Avengers and Captain Marvel and, you know, all the like the Pixar stuff, Toy Story 4, Frozen 2's coming out soon. You have new Star Wars stuff, all, you know, coming out all the time. And what's interesting this year is that there's going to be like kind of a showdown because a month after Comic-Con is D23, which is the Disney, basically the Disney Comic-Con, where it's all Disney. It's in Anaheim near Disneyland. So, you know, and from what I gather, Disney is going to be at Comic-Con this year. But, you know, what are they going to, like, show some good stuff at Comic-Con? Or are they going to wait to for their own convention?
Right, right.
So.
Another comment I saw was that, like, isn't it interesting that they're, like, deciding to skip out when it's two female, like, helmed movies?
Right.
In terms of Wonder Woman 1984 and I forget the other one, sorry.
But Birds of Prey, you mean?
Yeah, but anyway, the implication was that maybe there is something gender related, maybe on that part.
Yeah, it's.
I'm just trying to like throw out everything that I've heard. I don't.
Yeah,
believe
no.
that. I just think
you never know. I mean, because I mean, this is this you know approximately the same audience that, although. I will say from my experience, like the Comic-Con, the people who go to Comic-Cons or Fan Expo or wherever tend to be a different crowd, or at least on the face a different crowd than people who snipe and gripe on the internet. The comic convention people tend to be overwhelmingly positive.
Right.
Whereas people on Twitter are overwhelmingly negative. And I'm not sure if there's like some sort of weird Venn diagram that, you know, there's people who can... for lack of a better term, two-faced,
right,
and can be positive, and then also, well, and then behind their computer screens being negative, but it could, you know, that could have something to do with it,
right? So
it wouldn't surprise me.
Instead, what we get is clips from a movie no one really needed clips from, or hype about a movie no one really needed hype from, which was It 2.
right, that's opening. That's the opening night attraction as they're screening It 2.
Right.
Which doesn't, yeah, it doesn't need the help. And then there's going to be a Game of Thrones, like, sort of wrap-up event in Hall H, which should be awesome given the reactions to Season 8.
Right. Yeah.
All right.
That'll just be a blast.
It will be a blast. We'll have a blast too. We're going to take a break and then we're going to come back with talking about famous box office failures that maybe shouldn't have failed. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. That is Metric and the song Black Sheep. You may recognize it better, though, as the song by Clash at Demon Head that they perform in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. But no, it's Metric, not Brie Larson with Brandon Routh on bass. But we mentioned Scott Pilgrim because in an article in The Independent, they listed 35 of the biggest movie flops that shouldn't have been flops. And of course, it's like summer movie season, and you know, people are concerned about box office and things. And I want to talk about this list because, like,
I don't really like lists like this,
You don't like lists?
They're just not lists like this, okay? It's like, where it's just a laundry list of movies that bombed and you didn't even try to, like, explore why they bombed.
Well, this is the thing, too. With this list, they had on it Children of Men, which I don't think was going to be a hit under any circumstances. It's not that type of movie.
And I would like to add, I actually saw Children of Men in theaters in 2006. It came out on Christmas Day.
It did. Great counter-programming.
Yeah. Did anybody mention that when they were talking about it bombing? It's like...
Yeah, it was...
The theater was empty. I remember this, right? And I was like 16 years old.
Yeah. Like, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Yeah.
Great movie. Was never going to be a hit.
Right.
Black Hat. Chris Hemsworth as a hacker.
So what's worse, calling that a good movie that bombed, or...
Well, it bombed for sure, but I don't think
I
it was a good...
I don't think it's a good movie, yeah.
No, and certainly the reviews bore that out. But like, also on the list was like Man on the Moon, which was Jim Carrey using method to channel Andy Kaufman. Again, good movie, good performance by Jim Carrey. Was not going to be a blockbuster. Same with Mulholland Drive. It was directed by David Lynch.
Yeah. Is anybody baffled that that didn't make twice its budget?
Mother by Aronofsky.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't going to be a hit. You know, they got things like Hugo, which I'm pretty sure Hugo is Martin Scorsese's most successful movie ever in terms of like making money.
I thought it was The Wolf of Wall Street.
It might be, but I think it might be Hugo.
Okay, yeah.
We'll fact check that later. But, but you know, they're characterizing it as a bomb. It didn't make a lot of money, but it certainly wasn't a bomb.
Well, again, that's why I take exception to these, because it's like, how many people nowadays talk about Waterworld on its own terms, and how many people talk about it as the biggest bomb of all time?
It's like, I'm not even sure it's the biggest bomb.
I don't think so either. Honestly, I think it's been totally exaggerated. But my point is that there are many different reasons why movies bomb, right? One of the things we love to do as humans is take very complex or things that have very complex answers and reduce them to very simple formulas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, to come back to our friend Steven Soderbergh, right?
Everybody drink. He said him.
That's the great thing about a radio, right? You can't see me pulling the flask out of my pocket. Right? No. Right. But what did he say, right? What has he been saying for the last, like, 5 years? Saying it's cost way too much to make these movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you see on that list, Blade Runner 2049, another example of a movie that made, like, $239 million. But because you spent so much money making it, you had set yourself up to fail from the get-go, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so is it fair to call it a bomb, or is it fair to call it you spent too much money making it, right? And so that's, right? I labor about Steven Soderbergh a lot, but it's like, I don't see anybody else trying to figure this out, trying to reason through this the way that he is.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is just like, bomb, let's move on. He seems to be the only one that's like, let's explore why this is actually happening. But right, I agree with what you're saying. It's like, a lot of this is common sense. You can't blame people for not flocking to the theater to see Mulholland Drive.
Well, yeah, but you know, and some of these things on the list, you know, may not have made money. Like, this is Spinal Tap. You know, I can't think of anyone who hasn't, you know, at least heard of This is Spinal Tap, or at least felt its influence. Compare that to something like The Astronaut's Wife.
Yeah.
I don't know who's who is like, you know what movie I haven't seen? The Astronaut's Wife, and everyone goes, oh.
Yeah.
You know, but you get that reaction for Spinal Tap. You know, and I made a list a couple of years ago that was like about like movies that should have been bigger hits but weren't. And on it, I had like things like The Abyss, which is a James Cameron movie. I think The Abyss Stands is like one of James Cameron's only flops, if not his only flop. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you put in the advertising from the director of Titanic and T2 Judgment Day on a new trailer for The Abyss, does it still flop? I don't know. Something like Mystery Men, which, you know, was sort of pre the comic book movie boom.
Right.
Would like a send up like that work better today? The Wizard of Oz was a bomb right. when it came out, but now it's like a beloved classic. And one of the things the list did get right was It's a Wonderful Life, which did bomb when it came out, but is now like a staple. It's, you know, must see cinema.
Yeah. Well, everyone takes them to task for not appreciating the movie at the time, but it's like, yeah. That's just how it is sometimes. You know what I mean? Took like 30 years before we finally like agreed that Citizen Kane was as good as it was. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah, that's another one.
And now everyone loves to go, what? They passed on Citizen Kane for Best Picture? It's like, okay, well, if you were a part of the Academy in 1941, I would be hard-pressed to believe that you would also vote for it,
well,
right?
Time,
given the reputation that it has now.
Time wounds all heels, right? The people say the same thing now about Forrest Gump losing or winning over Pulp Fiction and Shakespeare in Love winning over Saving Private Ryan. And...
Right. But it's interesting what you're saying because, again, coming back to Soderbergh's analysis of Side Effects, right? He mm-hmm. was like, well, we had this movie that featured people that were, you know, on prescription medication, but we didn't go too far with mm-hmm. it. So did that make the movie seem more generic or more marketable, right? Mm-hmm. It's like these are things that you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because they arguably have some of the most sophisticated algorithms in Hollywood for figuring out mm-hmm. what will make money, and they still can't do it, right?
No.
Again, what did Soderbergh say about Magic Mike? They predicted it would do $19 million on its opening weekend, and it ended up doing $38 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like 100% wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is also that we're trying to be perfect, right? We
mm-hmm.
are trying. We're forgetting that this is an art,
mm-hmm.
and that you can't predict with absolute certainty these things the way that you can maybe with other things in our society.
Mm-hmm. No, it's, you know, there's an X factor, you know. You put Tom Cruise in a movie in a mech suit fighting aliens, theoretically that should be, you know, a license to make money, but it doesn't. You get a cast that includes Ben Stiller and Hank Azaria and Janine Garofalo, like people who are like the sort of the titans of comedy in 1999, put them in a movie where they're pretending to be superheroes, should be a license to permit money. You put Harrison Ford in a futuristic movie where he's a cop shooting, hunting androids.
That was Spaceballs, right?
No. Spaceballs. Blade Runner. But, you know,
yeah.
Theoretically, that should work. And, you know, there are a lot of people at the time like, ooh, Harrison Ford, Han Solo in a sci-fi movie, and then get there and it's Blade Runner. And how quickly it all turns.
But if history has taught us anything, it's that people need time to appreciate these things, right?
Oh, yes.
Like that, it's not the last word. I mean, history says that, but the studios are not saying that, right?
Yeah.
It's like they are essentially just kind of moving on, considering it a failure, and then let's move on to the next thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like sometimes these... especially challenging things like, let's say, Blade Runner, they will find a voice. They will find a life
yes.
everywhere else. So their value yes. isn't based on how much money they made at the box office.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
I would still argue it's been 20 years and the astronaut's wife still hasn't found a voice.
and I will just end on this, right? So now... You're absolutely right, but now we're moving into television, right? So
yes.
now television is the big like behemoth of storytelling, right?
For sure.
So it's like you can't measure that in terms of box office numbers. So what are they doing now? I see Netflix doing this on Twitter all the time. They're like 8 bajillion viewers just saw our new Netflix original, right? They're using viewers,
mm-hmm.
like how many people are watching it as
yeah.
an indicator of its quality. And I'm like, okay, but that doesn't mean that the movie was good, right? It's like whenever Doug Ford talks about Jobs, we're going to put Jobs here. We're going to do Jobs. And I'm like, okay, but what kind of Jobs? Right. Like, right? It's like it's not a means to an end, sorry.
Well, it's worth noting too, Netflix, there's no independent verification of their numbers. They don't release the numbers unless it's in the name of promotion,
right,
as you were saying. So right. It's that's a whole other level of black hole we won't get into today. But speaking of giving things time to appreciate.
You've got some wine on you? Is that
I wish. It is pretty early in the afternoon for me. But no, it's the 35th anniversary of the release of Ghostbusters and Gremlins, which came out on the same weekend in 1984.
Yes. And as I discovered, Top Secret was supposed to come out on that weekend as well. We almost had three 80s American classics released on the same
weekend. Would never happen now.
No.
You never get like two movies of kind of like a similar type like this, because of course if Ghostbusters and Gremlins were released now, somebody somewhere would already be working on Gremlins 2 and Ghostbusters 2, and they'd be, you know, maybe even like coming up with the cinematic universe like Ghostbusters in France.
Yeah, how can we tie this into a Netflix series? Like,
yeah, maybe. It's just crazy to think. Also, I feel like these two movies are tied in a way, because there's obviously a great deal of appetite still in building franchises around them. But they have not been able to get a Gremlins remake off the ground.
Why is that?
It is curious. But I think that it, you know, maybe it's just me, but I think there's a sort of weird connection between the aesthetic of Joe Dante, which was very like comical and cartoonish, but at the same time sadistic, and the kitschiness too of having the animatronic Gremlins. Because if you make Gremlins now, they'll be CG, or you know, the actors will be looking at blue tennis balls. Like, this is where Gizmo's gonna be.
It
just doesn't feel the same. But when you see like the puppetry and the animatronics, it feels more tangible. It feels more different. So I feel like those are the two things working against anyone trying to remake Gremlins. So they're going to have to be satisfied with the 4K re-release of Gremlins on HD Blu-ray, you know, next, I think, sometime this fall.
One of the interesting things, because I looked up the sort of conception of Ghostbusters, I was actually like quite surprised to see that Dan Aykroyd apparently has been like totally enamored with like the paranormal his whole life.
Yeah.
Like his mother apparently like saw ghosts. Apparently his like grandfather tried to like contact ghosts using like radios. Apparently like, I don't know. He's had a lot of affiliation to this kind of stuff, and it's been a, like a lifelong fascination for him.
All the esoteric stuff in Ghostbusters, like when he like talks about the book stacking incident of 1909, you know,
it was
in
like
the
real
film, that's like Dan Aykroyd's like knowledge that he's gathered over the years of like paranormal.
That makes sense to me.
But yeah, like the making of Ghostbusters is fascinating, because it was like Dan Aykroyd's idea. And it was like this kitchen sink of like just paranormal gobbledygook, and
set in space. Apparently, the first draft.
That's right. But then Ivan Reitman comes in and goes, "No, no, let's like real worldize this a bit."
Yeah.
And then they both go to Harold Ramis, who comes and then sort of like is able to like clear like the extraneous bits that Aykroyd had, and it was able to streamline the story a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to Ghostbusters 2, which this is like the 30th anniversary of Ghostbusters 2 this coming weekend. But, you know, when you hear that story, how they basically like took Murray, Reitman, Ramis, and Aykroyd with a couple of like Hollywood agents and like basically, I don't want to say held them hostage in a Beverly Hills restaurant, but kind of, and like made them like hammer out like, yes, they were going to go forward with Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, and they only gave them 13 months for the first one,
yes,
too. Like, they had to kind of plow through that.
Yeah.
They went to Martha's Vineyard to finish the script, apparently.
Well, good work if you can get it. But it speaks to me that, you know, there's going back to our last discussion, there's an organic nature to this that you just can't force. And it feels like, you know, for 25 years, Dan Aykroyd was trying to get a Ghostbusters 3 going, and then they do the remake, and now they're doing with this Jason Reitman sort of reboot, third sequel kind of thing. And it's just like, you can't force these things. They have to come from an organic place.
Yes, yeah.
And it's...
It's so really, why are we even like, and we shouldn't even be supporting a Gremlins remake, because it sounds like it's going on the same principle.
No, no, I'm not in favor at all. I think we got a Gremlins sequel, Gremlins 2 The New Batch, which is horribly underappreciated. Well, let it be. You want more Gremlins? Go watch Gremlins 2.
All right.
That's all I got to say about that. All right, we'll have plenty more to say about our review of the week, which is Booksmart, coming up. And this is some new music from Orville Peck, who will be at Hillside Festival on July 14th. That's Queen of the Rodeo, and then we're going to talk about Booksmart. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. Beyond this town lies a life much sadder, babe. Another evening show.
Calendars and make thy plans to attend the drama department's summer program, Shakespeare in the Park. Gingla.
We will be performing the Bart's comedies as modern tragedies outside Whole Foods across town.
It's actually funny. It's what we did in my summer program last year in Barcelona, when I lived in Barcelona. I will be directing, and Alan may be starring pending auditions.
I don't audition. I'm offer only.
This looks fun, but I'm not gonna be here.
Yeah, Amy's spending the summer in Botswana helping women make their own tampons. That's
gross.
Well, blood attracts lions. I'm saving lives.
Oh, okay. Well, that's actually noble. I, too, have a fear of big cats.
And I can't, because I'm working all summer, and also I don't want to.
You are a Philistine.
Why would you do theater when you could do debate?
Because some of us enjoy working with others.
And some of us know how to win.
Nobody's winning in that outfit.
Oh, dear. How saucy. Anyway, that is a clip from Booksmart. It's a new film from Olivia Wilde, and it stars Caitlin Dever, Beanie Feldstein, Billy Lord, Skylar
Gizondo. Where was Bernie?
That's me, Bernie Sanders. I'm a high school student. Anyway, Jessica Williams and Jason Sudeikis, a.k.a. Mr. Olivia Wilde. This was so much fun.
Yeah, I had a good time with this. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't want to say it's nonstop hilarity, but it's pretty close.
It has that pace of these kinds of movies, these like just before graduation kind of high school coming of age type movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That I know originated before Superbad, but for me kind of started with Superbad. That kind of mile a minute, they're like trying to get to the party and things keep like preventing them from getting to the party at, you know, a very quick pace kind of thing.
There's a great gag in it, though, that they keep saying, like, we want to go to the big party, and they keep being diverted to these other parties.
Yeah.
with other people in their class. There's this one big party that the one kid, Nick, is having. But, you know, because it's the last night of high school, everyone's sort of having gatherings or, you know, some kind. So they keep getting diverted, which leads to a scene that I've never seen in a high school party movie, the stop at the library to do hardcore research into where the party is, where the real party they want to go to is.
Yeah.
Where they're like examining videos and things.
I thought you were going to say that the cops show up and break it up.
No, no. Well, I mean, that's inevitable. that's the fun thing about this is that, you know, the tropes are there, that, you know, it's two girls, you know, they're going their separate ways. They're, you know, trying to capture all the fun that they didn't have. There's a big party. Things are disclosed. They learn things about each other and about their friendship. And then, you know, the cops break up the party, and then there's the reconciliation. And
yeah, it plays into a concept that was introduced to me by Roger Ebert a long time ago, who said that a movie isn't about what it's about, it's how it's about it, right?
Yeah.
So the formula is very, very familiar, right? But yeah, it's how they go about the formula, right? It's the banter between the two girls that mm-hmm. is so good. And there's something about these kinds of comedies where it's like they have kind of inside jokes, and they have the certain behavior that they do with each other that hasn't been established, but we can right. all tell is like real, you know what I mean? Because we all do that with our friends. We just have right. things that like are kind of bizarre, right? Like in Bridesmaids, when they both have like, I don't know, like cake on their teeth or something. It's just one of those fun little things that like friends do. And they capture that so well in this, I think.
Yeah, there's right from the outset where Amy picks up Molly and Molly comes out and they start like dancing.
Yeah.
Talking about how, you know, what a good day it's going to be and how they both look, you know, good for the day. And they're both dancing like in the middle of the street. And they're like, are we going to go to school now? No, right. We're never going. it's just delightful. And one of the things I appreciated was that even though it as you said, it's how you do it. But I think one of the more important differences, and this plays into the 21 Jump Street movie, where, you know, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill go back to high school, and it's completely different. You know,
yes,
the old cliques are gone. The nerds are the cool kids. The jocks are the uncool kids. Up is down.
You can't
block
wear a
is
backpack
white.
With one shoulder.
That's right. That's right.
Or you can't put the backpack on both arms.
And you know, granted, I haven't stepped foot in a high school. Well, that's not true. I took part in a CFRU live broadcast from GCVI when they were doing their tech fair a couple of months ago. So I have been in a high school lately, not as a participating student, I will add. But it's
Star Wars came out that year, didn't it?
Almost. I mean, I graduated high school in 97, and the special editions came out that year.
Oh, okay. So,
that's
give or take a couple decades.
That's not inaccurate.
Right. Okay.
I haven't been in high school like for years, so I don't know what the cliques are or where the lines mm-hmm. are. But, you know, as someone who has watched his share of high school movies and TV shows, you know, in the intervening time, you know, it is nice to see kids who don't fit into easily packaged roles, and that, you know, you do have the theater clique, but, you know, as you heard in that clique, the theater guys are not to be trifled with.
Right.
And are more than willing to stand up for, you know, Shakespeare in the Parking Lot and its cultural value, as opposed to, you know, Molly and Amy, who are very much into, you know, political action and making sure that the school council budget for the next year is set, even though they're not going to be there, and
right.
and other things, and going to Botswana to make tampons. And it's nice. It's refreshing.
Yeah. And it's coming off the heels of another movie, The Long Shot, that felt maybe an emerging trend of being like much more open politically. You know what I mean? Not beating you over the head with it, right? But just, it's like, okay, we don't need to have the backstory about the queer person who is confused about their sexuality. It's like, okay, we can just treat it as if it's any other high school movie. She's got a crush on a woman, and let's like not make it turn it into a thing. You know what I mean?
Right. It's unapologetic. In the hands of a lesser person, there'd be, you know, things about like she hasn't come out.
I was waiting for that kind of stuff, and they never really did it, which I appreciate. Right. It's like, you know, she's got whatever, the Elizabeth Warren sticker on her, like, her right. bumper. We know where they stand politically. We don't need them to, like,
right,
beat us over the head with it.
Yeah, right? There's subtle little jokes in there, like when they tell the principal, "We will persist," which, of course, is a reference to Elizabeth Warren. And
right.
When Mitch McConnell tried to stop her from speaking in the Senate. And yeah, it's political, but it's not like nauseatingly political. And I say that as being someone who also works in the political realm. But
right, yeah.
There's a very naturalistic feel to it that I imagine the actors are probably in their late teens, early 20s, and not necessarily high school age, mm-hmm. but there is an authenticity to the way they talk
yep.
and to what their references are and how they relate to one another. It's not overly antagonistic. There is antagonism between the different groups, but
yeah.
it's never, you know, it doesn't feel, you know, the characters you would consider the quote unquote evil kids, like the James Spader in Pretty in Pink, that's kind of not there. Everybody is kind of like chaotic neutral in that regard.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
there's no evil kids. There's like kids who maybe misunderstand other kids.
I will just say that it did kind of lose some of its steam for me towards the end.
Mm.
It hit the very like necessary beats
mm-hmm.
where there's a conflict between them.
Yeah.
I will just be that vague.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they, like, make up, right? And they've learned things about each other and their friendship. But I felt like there wasn't enough of a period where they reflected on
mm-hmm.
things. It was just, like, it was too immediate. They got back together and then everything was perfectly fine. It's like there wasn't, I don't know, maybe I was looking for more of a classic Hollywood, what did it mean kind of thing.
Right.
But instead, I think they were just trying to do the same old formula just with, or not the same old formula, but like a classic formula with just different kind of characters.
I think there's sort of a whiplash effect with kids at times where, you know, they can be yelling at each other 1 minute and then turn that off and go back to being friends another minute. You know, maybe holding that grudge maybe is inconsequential. One of the things I was thinking about at the end of this movie is that it's not necessarily a spoiler to say that, you know, they both kind of go their separate ways at the end of the movie, or they're about to go their separate ways. And one of the things I will say is that despite the fact you see this solid friendship, these two souls who, you know, have been through the high school trenches together, I found that it's remarkably not as like nostalgic, sort of like as at the end of Superbad, where it's like when Jonah Hill and Michael Cera go their separate ways at Superbad, it's like it feels more wrought, it feels more emotional than it does at the end of Booksmart,
right? Yeah.
Where there's like sort of like if I remember correctly, Superbad ends at the mall and Michael Cera goes off with Emma Stone and Jonah Hill goes off, or vice versa,
with someone else. Yeah,
yeah, but you know, and they kind of do this like longing glance back at each other.
Yeah,
I feel like it's that was more emotive than where we sort of leave off at Booksmart, where it's like, well, this is kind of the end of our journey. But
yeah, and I also like the fact that they do kind of change the trope of them going off to college. She's going to Botswana
yeah.
to do something that's like clearly socially meaningful, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's not really perpetuating that idea of like, you know, but I will just say that I am getting a little tired of the scenes of like the misty-eyed parents who are about to see their children off to college. And it's like, okay, we have social media, you have phones, you'll probably come back next weekend for a visit. Like, why are you crying so hard? It's like, it's just not anywhere close to the experiences that me or any of my friends have experienced going off to college. So it's like,
yeah.
I feel like now it's getting, and again, right, I'm not American, so like
right.
maybe it just works differently there.
Yeah.
Maybe it's more of a permanent kind of
yeah.
Event, right? The kids are going on to the next stage. But for me, it was like, I'm going to college, but I'm still tied to my home. So
right.
it's not quite as dramatic, right? The reason they do that is because they're trying to milk the big emotions that those scenes
right.
do.
Well, I will say that at least in Booksmart, it's tempered somewhat because of a panda bear in who, which it's implied certain things have been done to.
Right. Yeah, which is also kind of an old like gag, right, that was done in American Pie. Like,
it makes it uncomfortably awesome, though.
Yeah,
I was enjoying that. I want to especially highlight Billy Lord, who plays Gigi in this, and is this a character who clearly has probably spent a bit too much time with Mary Jane, or
right.
some. Although it's implied that her drug of choice is crushing up her vitamins and snorting them.
Right.
But it's this wonderful character who just sort of like pops up at these various locales that they go to and
yeah.
sort of like a magical genie character.
It happens in all these kind of movies, right? Jason right. Sudeikis, the principal, just magically shows up as like their,
as an
their
Uber liber,
yeah, their Lyft driver or whatever. Yeah, it's like, okay.
But,
they're clearly not going for like... a continuous logic here.
Right. But I will say that despite that, I feel like this is sort of a bit more grounded than a lot of these like high school party movies, like something like Project X, where it's just like so over the top.
Yeah.
Even Superbad to extent where they're like going into situations where there's like violent people and bikers and things.
And, yeah, hanging out at like a high school party.
And right, and like the things that, you know, in Booksmart are like they go to, you know, one kid's party and are given like edibles. And then they go to another party where the edibles start taking effect. And there's this entire sequence where they think they've become dolls.
Right.
And you see them like walking out of the house all stiff, you know, like we're going now because they still think they're dolls. And that's kind of like the most sort of over the top this goes. Most of the things that sort of happen are in a very believable level. And I will say that too, of there's a sex scene in the movie between Amy and a girl she meets at the party.
Yeah, there's always an awkward sex scene in all these coming of age high school movies. I was like, oh, where is it? Because I know right. it's here.
But the awkwardness in this one I felt was it wasn't just done for laughs. There was like a sort of a genuineness to the awkwardness, sort of that.
Sort of.
Yeah.
It actually reminded me of a movie called The Kids Are All Right, which I thought hit the beat that they were trying to go for better than they did, actually.
Right.
The daughter who's kind of confused about her identity and herself. I don't mean like she's queer or anything. I just mean like she's at that
questioning.
Age.
Yeah.
Right. And she makes a very like abrupt kind of in the moment decision to make out with the crush, right? And I feel like that's, and then she realizes that she's her emotions have like kind of resulted in this kind of bad decision, right? And I feel like that's what they were trying to say with that moment.
Yeah,
and they didn't do it very well.
Well, I thought they maybe
well they
did
didn't
it a
do
bit,
it as effectively as they could,
right? But you know, in terms of sort of you know how these movies go, I thought it was handled very well, and I think I attribute that to Olivia Wilde, who has done more than her share of sort of like teen movies.
is it though? But she's directing, right? Like
yeah.
she's been acting in movies for like 10 years.
Oh, for
but
sure.
Now she's directing it,
yeah.
So it's like. I appreciate that these actors think they've gotten a lot of experience just by working with directors, but I don't think that's the case, right? It's like...
Well, I think she shows a lot of promise. Like, I think the swimming pool scene...
That was one good shot.
It was a good shot,
I don't know if that was... I don't know if it was good directing as a result of one good shot.
Let's recognize the auteur school.
All right. I had to throw in my, like, you know, devil's advocate nonsense anyway. So that's all I'm doing.
Fair enough. And unfortunately, that will be the end of the nonsense for this week. We hope you liked our show.
I'll be back for Toy Story 4 in a couple of weeks, hopefully.
Good tease.
So, you know, dolls.
Yeah. In the meantime, you can listen to this show again. You can visit us at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Find us on social media at Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Vince, where can people find you on the internets?
At VMassin5 on Twitter.
All right, and I can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can check out my political stuff at guelphpolitico.ca. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow, Thursday at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph, and that is with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.